village crossed about. But I remember someone telling me last week a story about philosophers. It seems that this story was told by Dean Rusk to a group of people at the State Department, that he came from a town so small that they didn't have a village philosopher. Each of them had to take turns. And I suggest that that's what forums are all about, that we are all philosophers. We all think about the things that we hear here at Holden, and we all come to some sort of conclusions or at least prejudices. And I'm hoping that during these evening hours at 9 o'clock from Monday now and through Friday, that we can share our insights, our assumptions with one another. Tonight we've asked Eric Jorsted, who some of you have been familiar with for some of his work, to talk about sanctuary. Churches have been involved in sanctuary now for a while, and subtitled, Should Christians Break the Law? It's not a presentation, remember that, please. It's a forum where all of you are invited to participate after the initial introductory remarks.
Thanks, Bill. Those of you who are at the 7 o'clock session found out that I delivered about 15 pages out of my thesis. So we've got about 307 pages to go, which I'll now summarize in the next 4 minutes. I just want to say a couple brief things to get us started here. How many of you were at the session at 7 o'clock? Oh, about two-thirds. Somewhere between half and two-thirds. I'm going to say just a few things. What is sanctuary? Just so we know, a couple definitions and a couple concepts to sort of get the ball rolling. Sanctuary is a short way of referring to the practice of what is now over 300 Christian and Jewish congregations around the country who have taken in refugees from El Salvador and or Guatemala. Why have they taken them in? Because the U.S. government, through the Immigration and Naturalization Service, or the INS, has a high likelihood, an order of 97% to 99% probability, that if they turned themselves in to the federal authorities, they would be deported back to their country of origin. The sanctuary churches and synagogues believe the situation in El Salvador is so grave that the reason why the people left in the first place is because of the torture, the murder, the human rights abuses, and so they don't want to see these people sent back. They protect them, they harbor them, they transport them around, they help them tell their story. It's a process of education. It's a process of protest against the U.S. government policies. And it's a humanitarian concern for the lives of the individual refugees with whom they deal. Are they breaking the law?
Oh my.
If someone here has more guts than I do, we've got a gooey mousetrap.
Oh.
Thanks, Charlie.
Appreciate that.
I was just about to speak about legal convictions and caught in the trap of the INS. That's too. I guess who that equates with mice, so I'm not going to say anything about that. No, this has been considered illegal by the U.S. Attorney General, who has ruled that he has the power to determine who are refugees and who aren't. It's not the power of churches to do that. The churches have encroached on the administrative territory of the U.S. government. They're pretending to be little governments to themselves. And they had expended $2 million in a 9-month investigation and 7-month trial in Arizona, which led to the conviction of 8 sanctuary leaders, including 3 clergy, a nun, and 4 lay workers, all in the Tucson and Nogales area of southern Mexico. All received probation. They could have received up to 25 years in prison And a $15,000 fine was the highest sentence possible for the one Darlene Nagorski. So the legal confrontation has heightened here between church and state, between the INS and the Attorney General and the sanctuary congregations and leaders. The question, should Christians break the law? If you're here in the previous forum or a session, you know I don't think they are breaking the law. I think international law should protect the rights of these refugees, and that on appeal, I hope and I in fact suspect that their conviction will be overturned, at least this aid, on the basis of the U.S.'s commitment to sustain the rights of refugees, genuine refugees. And these folks, if anyone in the world qualifies, it's the folks leaving El Salvador in the last 6 years. So should Christians break the law? The sanctuary congregations feel that it's a question of following the higher law of their conscience, of their obligation. They'd quote Acts 5:29, when Peter and the apostles were commanded to stop preaching the gospel, and they said, we must obey God rather than men. And they would quote that and say, we must obey our Christian gospel duty over Judge Earl Carroll of the Southern District of Arizona in court, or the U.S. Attorney General. They'd also quote, I'm gonna leave it there. I'm not going to launch into the whole thing. So it's a question of legal interpretation, and we follow through the appeals case. I'd be glad to field questions related to, you know, facts and laws and what's going on and so on. But it's also a question of Christian conscience. And when does a Christian decide that my duty to help the stranger, the neighbor in need, overrides the determination of the government officials? If ever, can Christians ever disobey what a government official says or a court says? And can they in particular, can it be justified in particular in the case of sanctuary? That's some of the rat's nest of issues. Mouse nests of issues that we have to deal with. So opening shots, yeah.
The question I have is, does that say that international law, that any given state or country does not have laws, they have to allow a certain number of people in certain places in, so the quotas and all that kind of stuff is valid?
Quotas are valid. The thing that you can't do, it has to do with first asylum. That means if someone gets into your country, you can't simply kick them out because you don't want them there. You have to determine who they are. They have prior rights. They have human rights before they have rights given by your government. So that in the case of Ethiopians fleeing into the Sudan, Sudanese under international law cannot just send them back into Ethiopia. They can't care for them either. They don't have the resources. It's the international agencies who step in and provide for them. And so when the Salvadorans land in our country, international law says we can't send them back to El Salvador. Doesn't say what we have to do with them here, what kind of legal status. There's all kinds of discretionary statuses that the Attorney General could give, short of giving them permanent refugee status here. But that's, you're not allowed to send them back to a place where human rights are abused.
Can you send them to another independent country other than their own?
Absolutely. That's why it's legal in Detroit, Michigan, where I live. We have the Overground Railroad, where if people get covertly into Detroit, an organization in Detroit works with churches in Windsor, Canada, and throughout Canada, so that once they present them, they've covertly gotten to the Canadian border checkpoint. Once they get there, it's all overground and official, and Canada will let them in if there's a sponsor. So a third country is always a possibility.
Can I just ask a question, though? Traditionally, though, the United States has felt very free to reject any international law that the administration or the people that are making decisions for us as a nation, they have felt free to, you know, not submit ourselves to any kind of international law.
Right.
I mean, I don't know that this is going to, it seems to me this would be one of the laws that our country would
Well, it'd be one of the laws our current administration would be inclined to disregard, considering what they've done on other Central American issues. But it's not necessarily what, say, the Supreme Court would decide. The U.S. Constitution, in Article 6, Clause 2, says that treaty obligations assumed by the U.S. Congress are equal to federal statute. Any law that's passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president is equally law with a treaty which is signed by the president and ratified by the Senate. So the Geneva Conventions, the UN Protocol on Refugees, are precisely equal authority as laws, according to our Constitution. Those international agreements have as much power in our courts as do any of the other laws passed. Now, it's up to the Supreme Court to enforce that and decision, and they haven't acted on this particular case. But politics and what current administrations have to do on different issues certainly says something. I'm an advocate of increased scope to international law. I'll be clear about that. So I'm on one side of that issue.
I mean, we have retreated the law of the sea. I mean, I could just go on. In the last 8 years, we've just retreated from every kind of international commitment or...
The administration has. The courts haven't. And that's where you have to be thankful for some kind of independent judiciary, although we're losing that in the federal branch judiciary, too. Yeah. As the rules of the forum is that you don't just have to address questions to me, and I'm not just going to be the sitting scholar here. I'll respond and I'll mediate and so on, but you can get going with each other and chime right in.
How many sanctuary churches are there in the United States today, do you know?
Just over 300.
Over 300?
As of June 86, yeah. As of this summer, it's over 300. There's also over 20 sanctuary cities, as large as Rochester, New York, and St. Paul, Minnesota.
Seattle
is a sanctuary city.
How many states are there?
New Mexico is a sanctuary state.
What?
One, New Mexico, which does border on Mexico, by the way, and deals with the problem.
How many states have sanctuary churches?
Oh, how many states have sanctuary churches?
They're
clustered in California in particular. Arizona, Texas is not quite so many. Illinois, a few other places. A third of them are in California. But that's where the refugees are. That's where half the refugees are.
Los Angeles is also a refugee city.
Sanctuary city? Okay.
Sanctuary city.
And what?
Davis.
Davis, California, and Berkeley and Oakland, I think, are. Yeah, so it's not just a religious issue anymore. It has to do
What does it mean for a city to be a sanctuary?
That means that they will not cooperate in any of the services provided by the city with the federal INS officials. And that's crucial. For example, if you're a refugee, you're there undocumented, and if the INS catches you, they'll deport you. Say you get in a car accident. Are you going to go to the hospital? If the police on the scene of the accident or the ambulance driver or the people at the hospital are going to report you, if they ask for your papers, if the local people say, no, we will not report you, that means that the people have access to police protection, to hospital care, to emergency services, and so on. So it's a significant step in the cities.
The cities technically really don't, it's just symbolic, isn't it? They don't really settle anyone.
Well, I'm trying to argue that it's a little more than symbolic, because they don't have any authority over federal, I mean, the INS can come in to a sanctuary city and arrest Salvadoran or Mexican or any undocumented person if the INS wants to. The federal government has the authority to do that. But the cities are saying we will not cooperate. And some immigration lawyers are calling it a crisis of legitimacy for the whole federal immigration system. And it's escalating.
It's gone. It seems to me that how do you scope out the magnitude of this thing? I mean, I can see this thing, as soon as you say, well, now we're really going to go all out and let all 10 or 16 million people in. And then we've got a few other millions all in South America and Latin America and Mexico, and the problem's probably going to get worse over the next few years.
Determined.
I can imagine it's going to be a horrendous problem. At some point, pragmatic, sounds to me that maybe some pragmatic people will be upset that their curves are being stepped on.
There are competing ideals in the American character, one of which is our openness and the Statue of Liberty and so on. But the other is a kind of we take care of our own And we don't like people who aren't quite like us. There's a kind of a dark side of nativist prejudice in our country that tends to come out in ugly ways along the border. There's a resurgence of that. There's a kind of anti-sanctuary volunteer group, which is an armed group going along trying to catch illegal entrants themselves, since the Border Patrol seems to be letting through all these people, and the government isn't quite sure what to do with them yet. So there's a reaction setting in from the other side. But it's more than just a, you know, stereotypical kind of prejudiced nativist stuff. There's serious questions of who can we accommodate and so on. But there's an important difference between a political refugee who is fleeing state-sponsored terror and an economic migrant, someone who is moving away from poverty, seeking jobs and a better life. And there is a real distinction between Mexicans and Salvadorans and Guatemalans, with the former being chiefly looking for a better job. And I don't begrudge that either, necessarily. But the Salvadorans and Guatemalans, who are fleeing organized state-sponsored terror in their country, and there's a different set of international and domestic laws that deal with the two of them.
Are there really different laws or just different ethics or standards? I mean, when you're saying that, are you actually saying there are actually written laws?
As of 1980, there are.
When you're fleeing terror versus just wanting to come to another country?
As of 1980, there are. Well, there's a section of the U.S. Code. It was 1980 U.S. Refugee Act, adopted by Congress. In a sense, it was kind of the last gasp in one sense, or the final expression of Carter's human rights policy. Which established a humanitarian definition of a refugee as distinguished from immigration ceilings. Previously, we just didn't have many people coming here for asylum claims. Before 1972, we averaged 500 a year, which the Border INS could handle pretty easily. Now it's about 25,000 a year.
And how are they classifying the Salvadorians?
The government is classifying them as 97% economic migrants, who they deport if they apprehend. 3% is the average over the last 5 years were receiving political asylum. So they're not being called political refugees. But what the sanctuary people are saying is that they ought to be.
They are political refugees.
They are political refugees, and they ought to be given safe haven, if not official refugee status, then at least allowed to stay here until they could go home safely.
My concern about this whole thing is, at what point does it stop? I mean, it seems like there's so many countries in trouble throughout the world that if we take the law into our own hands and we say, okay, you know, we're going to give them sanctuary or so on, at what point does it stop? At some point, mm-hmm. there's going to be a problem in our society. And I guess the question is, are we right to take the law into our own hands any more than the lynching mobs were right to wrong to do what
well,
they
there's
did.
Two questions you're asking there. One is, do we reach the breaking point? Can we really take in all 10 to 16 million refugees worldwide? And, you know, what is the capacity of our compassion is that question. And the second question is can we take the law into our own hands in determining this too? If we disagree with what the government's determining on that number, can we bring them in ourselves and provide care and shelter and so on
for them? Or can we do something to change the law? Can we put that same amount of energy into changing the law as opposed to putting that energy into breaking the law?
Right. That's a good question. And the sanctuary leaders themselves would say that they put all the possible energy into changing the law. And in fact, the Southside Presbyterian Church, where John Fife is the pastor, and he's sort of considered the leader of the movement in some ways, they're a party to 4 lawsuits in civil courts, civil lawsuits against the government for various actions. They're seeking injunctive relief from the government, from the courts, in 4 separate kinds of cases. And the ALC is party to a lawsuit, and a number of sanctuary churches have joined in a lawsuit against the Attorney General and the INS. And they're pressing the courts, they're pressing legislation, they're working with the State Department and the Attorney General and the INS as closely as they can. That's what they would claim, and all of it's not doing any good. They've been compelled to their actions, is what they claim.
Bring it back to the original point, because the law has said those kind of refugees can come in. The only difference is to define whether they fit under their category.
Right.
You almost don't need to change the law if you could just change it.
That's my claim about the whole thing, is that sanctuary isn't breaking any laws. It's the government that's breaking good laws. And so instead of seeing sanctuary as civil disobedience, breaking bad laws or trying to change bad laws, I see it as trying to uphold good laws, which the government itself is breaking in this case. And it's not yet decided in the courts. It's the courts which are independent enough to determine this, as opposed to the executive or the attorney general.
That's by your definition of whether a political refugee or an economic.
That's part of it. That's appealable, and it's working its way through the courts, too. And there's some quirky and interesting decisions going on in various circuits and appeals courts around the country, and it's not yet clear exactly what's going to happen. You have to watch in the next year and a half or so.
But there's something a little false about that, because, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but if it runs the course and the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, these are economic migrants and we need to send them back, sanctuary is not going to change what they're doing. They're going to, I would assume, they're not going to say, oh, well, we were wrong all along, we'll stop what we're doing.
No, probably not.
They're going to say, well, we go one step higher. So why? It's not pointless to try to run the legal course, but I think the statement, perhaps it is being said at the same time, we appeal to a higher authority that acts first, you were saying.
Right.
It's got to be stated simultaneously.
Those things are both clear in there, and they're trying to be good Christians and good citizens. They're not trying to be revolutionary underminers of the civil order. They're trying to show their good faith patriotism in following through the legal process. But they're also trying to be good Christians at the same time. And they don't want to see push come to shove where they have to choose between the two. And I'm saying that time hasn't yet quite come to have to make that choice. But it may, and then it's going to get even more interesting. Yeah.
Why are we really afraid of these refugees from El Salvador?
Good question.
Anybody have an answer? Remember, Eric's not the final arbitrator here. It's a whole thing.
I'm definitely not.
Yeah, part of it is that our government is supporting the government down there. You know, so Reagan is, you know, supporting that government, giving them aid. And he would be embarrassed to say supporting the government that's sponsoring all this state and terrorism. I mean, obviously it's going on, but by accepting all these refugees, he'd be admitting, you know, finally that, yes, we are supporting a corrupt state. It's not ready to do that.
It would be illegal then, too, isn't
that? It'd be illegal to give military aid to a state that was committing that kind of human rights abuse.
Well, what are these people doing that they're getting into such a bind in their own country?
Well, it's a good question. Why? Try to picture a territory the size of the state of Massachusetts. It has about 5 million people, had about 5 million people. 1 million of the people have fled their homes. 20% of the population has fled their homes. Half of them have left the country, half are displaced within the country. How could a situation be so dramatically disturbing that so many people would leave their homes? That's what it's like in El Salvador. And what Sanctuary Movement claims, together with Amnesty International and others, that is chiefly government-sponsored death squads that have been causing the worst of the violence. The guerrillas have caused their share of terror as well. It's actually increased in the last couple of years a bit, but still far short of what the government has done, along the lines of 90% to 10%, is what Amnesty International would say. So that's...
So you're saying the upheaval in El Salvador is creating these people to be dislocated, and they look to the United States for economic relief.
At least for a safe place to stay.
Sounds to me like it's economic relief, and I think it falls right into the government's hands and thinking about the fact that they're moving here for economic purposes.
Well, I'm not sure you understand what's going on in El Salvador then, because it's...
Tell me, I don't know.
Maybe someone else can speak a little bit to that. I can keep talking. But... Since the coup, which changed the government in 1979, in the area of 50,000 to 60,000 civilians have been murdered in El Salvador. Remember, that'd be in the equivalent of the state of Massachusetts with 5 million people, about 50 to 60,000 people. Imagine Metro Detroit or Metro Houston or LA having 50,000 people murdered, mostly by the government. It's created such a sense of upheaval, and not just murdered, but brutally. I mean, bodies without heads dumped in the streets, and pregnant women bayoneted in the stomach, and children being slaughtered and toyed with, and just horrible mass massacres throughout the countryside and in the cities over the last several years, documented by our own State Department among other institutions. And people have fled for their lives. Let me tell a story instead of spinning off all this stuff. Brenda was a member of Lutheran Church in San Salvador, working with a refugee camp that's sponsored by the Lutheran Church. And when she was about 15 years old, she was participating in a demonstration in front of the cathedral in San Salvador, protesting the fact that the government had killed a bunch of university students. What we do in this country all the time and don't think twice about it. Well, the tanks moved in and she fled with all the people into this garage. The tank came in, crushed down the garage door, and opened fire, and she was covered with a sea of dead bodies and blood. And it was only by playing dead under the heap that she escaped being killed herself. She got out of there, and she continued her work in the refugee camp until the pastor and the secretary and the doctor in the camp were arrested, some of them beaten and tortured, and they said, "You other workers are next." She said, I don't want to lose my life. I'm going to get the heck out of here." She got the heck out of there, and she ended up coming through Mexico, where she isn't much safer than El Salvador, and into this country, and received sanctuary. So that's one story of a person who had been part of indiscriminate violence and then particularized threats and led her to leave.
Why would these people come to the United States, which is not offering them any sanctuary?
Mexico isn't either. And in Mexico, they're subject to... What? There's what?
Cuba.
Cuba?
Does Cuba offer them sanctuary?
Well, there happens to be an ocean between El Salvador, an ocean as well as El Salvador doesn't border on the Caribbean Ocean, they only border on the Pacific, so that's a tough one.
This whole issue of economic, the seeking out of economic, of a job or prosperity or a life for your family can't be separated out from asylum for political reasons, because you cannot, even if you weren't going to be tortured, if you're living in a country like that, you cannot have a decent job, you cannot provide for your family. That's as bad, I think, it's as bad as being tortured or being knifed or murdered. And I think that those two things are going to go hand in hand. And if I had a family in that country and I had not been tortured, I had not been murdered, and maybe I wasn't going to be faced with that immediately, I would want to go to a country where I could raise my family in peace. And the United States would be my boy. I'd want to go to the United States. I wouldn't want to go to Mexico. I wouldn't want to go to any of the other Central American countries or South America. I would want to go to the best. If I was going to make that move, I'd go to the country where I feel I could make the most for my family. And I really don't see a difference between those two things. I think they go hand in hand.
I can understand what you're saying, but I've also listened to refugees from like Guatemala and El Salvador speak, and they love their country. People in Guatemala, I think it's 80% are Indian, is that right?
Something like that.
The Mayan Indians. And they have a beautiful culture, and they have a beautiful, beautiful country. And the particular case that we listened to in my church maybe a month ago in Rochester, Minnesota, was a husband and a wife from Guatemala who, he was an accountant. He was a trained accountant in Guatemala, worked in Guatemala City, but his company had connections in outlying areas. And when he was working in those locations, he came in contact with some of the campesinos or some of the peasants. And as someone who has a good job, someone who's respected, the government could tell that he had been talking with some of the peasants in that area and became suspicious of him and started to do surveillance on his house and his wife and follow him to work. He used to have to take different paths to work to be avoided by these people. And they started thinking that he was subversive and threatening their lives. And he had no connections, political connections or aspirations, but he found that the harassment that both he and his wife received by security people coming into their house, questioning them, asking them what they're doing, was intolerable for he and his wife to stay there, much less his children. And they have just, within the last week, I received a letter from a woman in Rochester, received asylum in Canada, and they're asking for their children, the three children, to come. They don't want to leave their country, but they have no other alternative if they want to live, in some cases like that. And they spoke about how much they love their country and that in no way they could have a decent living here. So I think I can understand how many, Mexicans would say, I want to be more prosperous. But I think it's also from our cultural perspective that we always think that people want to come to America. Not everybody does, because they have beautiful homes and families, and their roots are there just as much as ours are here. And so that's something to interject also.
Yeah. How can we have two conflicting sets of laws on our books? We've adopted the International Geneva, and the refugee code and all that stuff, and they're on our books as law, and not the other laws that say.
Because there's three branches to our government. And the laws on the books are adopted by the legislator. The execution of those laws, they're carried out by the executive branch, the attorney general and the president. But it's the courts which determine just what those laws are. And so you've got laws and you've got the executive who's making their interpretation of what the laws mean. But they can only do that for so long until the courts step in and say, either yes, that is what they mean, or they say no, that isn't what they mean. And what we have now is a conflict, in my mind, between the statute and the U.S. Attorney General. And I think the Attorney General is breaking that statute. The court has not yet determined that, but it's working its way through. There's a civil case that'll press it here with a hearing coming up in October in particular.
Are the sanctuary workers having problems in New Mexico, or things in Mexico have set itself aside as a sanctuary state? Are the court systems there working?
Well, it's all, the courts are entirely federal. State courts have nothing to do with immigration concerns. So whether the state declares it or not doesn't affect the court decisions. You start with your district court, South District of Arizona or Southwest District of Texas or whatever, and then it goes to appeal to one of the 11, I think it is, circuit courts, and then to the Supreme Court. It's working its way through. But the state doesn't affect that. It's federal law.
This international law that makes this the difference is that it has to deal with human rights, and we've been following that, and even this administration saying, going around the world, but taking that's our big issue. Mm-hmm. How long the sea and a lot of these others that we have not been following and rejecting were kind of more dramatic things. But this is something where we clearly in the double talk. Mm-hmm. The only thing. I think we got ourselves really into something here when we say we're for all the human rights, we can jump around.
That's where the sanctuary movement calls the nation to put its practice in accord with its principles. And there's always a cost to the practice. Can we afford to put it into practice? But that's always the question of a principled nation. If we are more than a self-interested power that rules by the sword, but actually believes in freedom and democracy and liberty and human rights and so on, then can we put those into practice? Well, sanctuary movement would say, wake up.
Mm-hmm. What happens to these people? Is the sanctuary movement, are the people sanctioning this doing anything to employ these people? They can't get jobs without papers, can they? So what happens to them?
Well, they get employed through various friends of the congregation. That's where congregations are such wonderful networks. As opposed to just individual families taking care of them.
So they are employing them?
So they're working often, for example, a family in Detroit. There's one sanctuary family in Detroit. Most of them go across into Canada. But Raul is just a wonderful speaker, and he wants to stay there to share his message with his family. And he's teaching Spanish lessons. My wife took Spanish from him for a while. And he speaks all over the place.
Back to the society.
Yeah, they're chiefly, they'd love to have more status so they didn't have to sort of work around the edges of the official system, because they have to do it and they're always subject to personal threat, arrest, and so on.
And in an association that I'm involved with, the church in Hyde Park in Chicago, University Church, it's United Church of Christ, has sponsored a refugee family and has asked neighboring churches to assist in financial contributions, but mainly with prayer and understanding. And the people have come to our congregation and given Bible studies. And remember, most of the people that I've read about or have come in contact with are Christian people who worship the same God we worship, but experience the oppressiveness of their government in ways that we haven't expressed. So they participate in a lot of consciousness raising, particularly in and around the Bible. It's useful, I found, for University of Chicago students, particularly divinity school students, to come in contact with people who are refugees. Get quite an education.
I got a couple hundred in mind here, and I'll show them. One is, if I show 100,000, how long might the problem is? It's 1 million. And you spend 10,000 a year on each one of those, you're up to 1, 10, 20. How many believe you want to put out? And I guess the other, so I don't want to make my comment, the magnitude of the problem. How do the country, Mexico, not keeping them? How do they fit into this international law? I mean, the other countries of the world, I got sufficient France and other countries are not exactly the old hardly in favor of it.
What was that
France
last?
France and other countries.
Oh, they are. They think that the U.S. is crazy for our policy regarding Salvadoran refugees. The U.S. is an international outlaw when it comes to Salvadoran refugees. The United Nations has soundly condemned us for it. European allies have, not Britain and Germany, but France and Italy have, and the Scandinavian countries. Norway sends more money to El Salvador than the U.S. does, Norwegian Church. The Norwegian Church is very supportive of Salvadoran refugees. And Mexico is a peculiar case because they never signed the international agreements. They're not technically signatories to the Geneva Conventions or to the UN Protocol on refugees, so they never opted into that system. And from the people who describe it, the transit through in life in Mexico is terribly dehumanizing and oppressed and exploited. And there's every incentive to continue their journey further northward. And the Mexican authorities will deport them at any time, just like U.S., only with a little more violence. In terms of the cost, that first question, like I said, what's the cost of living to up to our principles? But the thing about these in particular, these are first asylum claims. These aren't people who are waiting in camps in Cambodia or the Sudan and so on, where the 90% of the refugees worldwide are. This is the few who managed to reach our shores. And it's a new thing because we've never had it quite like this in our history before, where they're reaching our shores. It's not Europe dealing with the problem of refugees after World War II, where we can send a little money over there and so on. But it's our own towns and cities, our own nation. So it hits close to home.
I think it's one of the few times where we actually have been hit with reality, because we've escaped a lot of things. Pastor Gomez came to San Diego and spoke with a group of us from several Lutheran churches around. He's a Lutheran. I think he's the Archbishop of El Salvador.
Bishop.
And it was very, very moving to hear what he said about the families that were broken up, and there are many, many Lutherans there, which makes no difference because they're all children of God. But we asked him what we could do, and he said, pray for the mothers, the fathers, the family,
everyone, because that's one thing that they believe in down there. They have found new faith in God, and they spend a lot of time in worship and a lot of time praying. It's an entire renewal of their faith. And that's the way we felt, because in the sanctuary movement in San Diego, the idea of getting somebody that comes to San Diego is to get them out of San Diego as fast as possible, because it's not the very best place to be, and to get them into Los Angeles, because there's a good network of people that will find a place for them to stay and something to do. But everyone who has helped them in the transition through San Diego has been very blessed by their presence, and the love of God just seems to be there when they come through.
I was just thinking about at least one video that just came out for the American Lutheran Church, Faces of Hope, or no, I'm not sure it is, but it's the church in El Salvador, and it deals with Pastor Gomez, the Lutheran pastor there, in Faye Esperanza, which is the Lutheran refugee camp run in El Salvador for refugees. And it's a very helpful, like, 28-minute video that you can get from ALC, maybe probably LCA and different congregations. So it's really helpful.
Worth looking for when you go back to your home church and try to say, what can we bring from Holden back to home?
It's
a good one. I don't know the title of it. I'm going to be showing a video tomorrow. My session tomorrow at 10:45 is on the lawsuit filed by the ALC and Elzona Lutheran Church together with the Presbyterians against the INS for the infiltration of church Bible studies. And I have a videotape associated with that, as well as some discussion time. Yeah.
The Sanctuary Network include being located in El Salvador, Guatemala, and contact the people who want to get out, provide them the financial resources to make that trip from there to the United States?
Nope. They're very, very careful on that one. And I happened to be sitting in a meeting in Tucson when I went down there for the ALC in late May. Sitting in the meeting where they formalized their decision as the Tucson Refugee Support Group on that one, they want to be very, very clear that Sanctuary is not motivated by the pull of drawing refugees into the country, but that Sanctuary is a response to the push of the situation that pushes them out of their home country. They specifically turn back particular individuals in this meeting where I was sitting with them, who had heard about this wonderful sanctuary that where you got your medical care and your food and housing, and had wanted to get out of Mexico City, where they had perfectly good jobs in a Salvadoran underground community there, and were doing organizing work with refugees there. They wanted to get out of there to get into the States to get this, you know, better sanctuary life. They turned them down. They said, "We're not going to help you. That's not why we provide sanctuary." But the people who are pushed by their situation, who come with a genuine and desperate need, they will respond to. And one of the problems, if you all live in the hinterlands, as they call it, anywhere away from the border, the heartlands, as with us in Detroit or Minnesota like to call it, but further away from the border, it's tempting to contact the people in Tucson or San Diego or Brownsville or El Paso and try to tell them just, you know, to recruit refugees to come into your sanctuary. And there's actually more sanctuaries now than there are refugees for them, because most refugees don't want to go public. They want to stay underground. Only 1 in 20 was Jim Corbett's estimate of how many actually go into public sanctuary of the ones that they assist. But they don't, in Tucson, they don't feel that they're a kind of church-based travel agency helping refugees see exciting places and meet new people. They're responding to a genuine political crisis that has to do with the terror that's gone on there. So they're very clear and careful about that one, and they've offended a lot of people in the hinterlands that have misunderstood that.
Well, it's just the people who are able to afford to buy their way out. The United States were able to make
Not really.
A lot of poor people who are suffering, oppressed.
There's a lot of people who are hitchhiking from a long road and walking. If you think you get tired walking to Cloudy Pass and back, or Copper Basin and back, try walking through the southwestern desert when you don't even know what a desert is. These people who are coming are motivated to do it, and they're going through incredible suffering just to get here. Probably not that much more suffering than some of our ancestors went through to get here, but probably more when you get down to it.
There's a good movie, El Norte, which shows them.
Yeah, I see some grimaces, which is people who can identify with that movie if you've seen it. I recommend that one.
Just a point of clarification. I know this may sound paranoid. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but when the INS made their arrests down in Arizona, it appeared to me that this was our government using an internal tool to support our position in Central America, and we talked a little bit about it before. Was that the general consensus of people involved?
No, actually.
You don't think that?
No, not the actual people involved. Now, what the director of the INS or the State Department had to think, that'd be another question. But having talked with the district director of the INS in Tucson, myself, and reading the accounts, my uncle happens to be a retired Lutheran pastor in Tucson, and he sent me the newspaper accounts almost day by day, so I got all the, local scoop all the time. The prosecutor, the INS, and the judge all believed that they were simply enforcing the law. This was a question of law-breaking, whether they had a collar on it. The district INS director said, I don't care which direction your collar faces, you can't hide behind your religious front. The law is the law. That was another quote. And it was very much a matter of enforcing the law, is how they felt they were doing. But of course, it's the interpretation of the law, which is the whole thing at issue. So they didn't see it as some kind of, they refused to comment on the broader foreign policy type stuff. And most of the administration doesn't. They say this is a case-by-case trial issue, and if other people draw their conclusions, that's their business.
And isn't it appropriate on the level at which it's been dealt with so far? I mean, should district courts be dealing with treaty?
Yes. Absolutely. It's the law of the land. According to the U.S. Constitution, the treaties have as much power as the federal laws. U.S. Code, 8th volume of the U.S. Code, 1254 A42, that they were enforcing, that has as much force as the Geneva Conventions, no more, no less.
Does it work that way practically, or are there other types of cases where...
Not very often. There's a variety of issues associated with that, but I'm advocating a particular view of international law here, too. But on a much more narrow basis, the people in the Tucson trial wanted to argue that they were compelled to do their actions, that they weren't doing it with the intent of breaking the law, but they were compelled to their actions by the actions of the government and the situation of the refugees. And the judge disallowed any defense on the basis of the motivation or the mental state of any sort. The beliefs, any of the beliefs of the defendants. And we're not allowed in the trial, and that's peculiar. That's going to be appealed.
But that's parallel to what's happened with, for example, wartime conditions. The same appeal to international law, the same disavowing of control testimonies.
Often the case, there's also a few idiosyncratic judges who are allowing a great deal of personal testimony. And those may prove more influential cases than the Tucson one, even on appeal. It's hard to tell.
Well, was there any precedent for disallowing beliefs and testimony?
Well, the judge made a mistake, as far as I can tell, on the question of intent. The law specifically says that you transport undocumented persons knowing that they're undocumented and intending to further their illegal presence in the country. It's called specific intent. You have to have knowledge of what you're doing. It calls for a certain kind of mental state. But he ruled that it was general intent, not specific intent. General intent means that you intend to commit the action, that you weren't drugged at the time, that you weren't drunk, that yes, you opened the door, put the Salvadorans in the car, and drove down the road. That's all that intent means. that you weren't mentally ill or incompetent or drugged at the time. He took that general intent notion when the law specifically, the clause specifically says specific intent, and if there's a specific issue that's likely to be overturned on appeal, that's probably the most likely. It's not all the other wonderful philosophical issues I'd love to see a court rule on, but it's probably that narrow, as I read it and as the defense attorneys who I talked with down there read it, mistake that the judge made.
What would be the implications, you know, if that's upheld?
Well, it'd certainly be hard for anyone who wants to assist undocumented persons in this country. Make it a lot more difficult.
Undocumented persons or refugees?
As far as the government's concerned, undocumented persons. As far as the sanctuary's movement's concerned, refugees. Yeah.
Does the Lutheran Church, ALC, LCA, or any other ones, feel that Christians should be breaking the law in the sanctuary movement? Have they taken any official?
Well, the ALC has taken a stand of a sort. The LCA doesn't have a policy. It doesn't have an official position, as far as I know. They have a position paper for discussion that you can get, and it's rather critical of some aspects of sanctuary. But the ALC has a position. It's part of the social statement adopted in 1984 called Human Law and the Conscience of Believers. It deals with war tax resistance. It deals with civil disobedience in a variety of ways. But there's a section on sanctuary. I happened to be on the staff and helped write that section at the time, so I know a little bit about what it says. But the decision was to say that we will remain in ministry with persons who decide to declare sanctuary. It says sanctuary is by definition a local decision that can only be made by a local congregation. A national church body can't provide sanctuary. The national church office at 422 South Fifth Street could provide sanctuary. But the national church body, I mean, you have to have a location, a place to provide sanctuary. It's a local decision. So there's colleges, there's a variety of places which provide sanctuary. But it's a local decision. But they say we support those who in good conscience decide to provide sanctuary. We also support those who in good conscience decide to minister with Central American refugees in other ways. And we especially encourage all people to work to reform the law and to see breaking the law, even as the interpretation or administration of the law, is only a last resort. And they set out seven conditions of doing that. And in practice, the sanctuary congregations have been supported, and so have those that haven't declared sanctuary. But they're certainly not like they're given money, but they're certainly... Chuck Lutz and myself and Mary Solberg and Phil Anderson and others have given them support in very ways. I don't think there's a policy statement here. There have been Salvadoran refugees here to speak.
What's going to happen after the merger? Which of those statements will be in effect? Mm-hmm.
When the merger takes place, there will be no social statements binding on the new Lutheran Church. None. All that there will be are the statements of predecessor bodies. Everything will be up for grabs, on everything from abortion to school prayer to sanctuary to you name it. It'll all have to be redone, just as it was redone in 1960 and 62. So that's going to be fun.
Point of clarification about, I think it's kind of hearing acknowledgement that there is a law, a federal law, and yet there's another law, the international law. I'm kind of sitting there listening more to what Buckley would be saying about that time, point in time. I understand the moral issues with it, but to understand how, you know, legally you're putting a point of law.
Buckley would say, and here's what a national security state-minded conservative would say, as far as I can tell, is that immigration is the kind of issue over which the executive branch has historically had almost unlimited power. To determine who gets in and who gets out. It's part of the definition of national sovereignty to be able to define, to control your borders and define who is a citizen and who is not. And if international law wants to make other kinds of things, age-old principles of international law is that nation states are sovereign over their borders. That's what a nation state is a government which is sovereign over its borders. Now that's been challenged post-World War II. And it's another strand of international law. He would appeal to pre-World War II type international law and Supreme Court decisions going back to the 1890s, and would appeal chiefly to national interest and national security as the grounds for giving the executive branch the power to determine that question. And the courts meddle, well, that's meddling courts, and we've seen lots of liberal meddling courts in the last 20 years, and he'd hope to see, especially in a new Chief Justice, that wouldn't happen so much. That would be my suspicion of what he would, some direction he might take with that.
So the nation, the sovereign state, does have its control of the board and its own laws. They're above any international interest or...
If international laws happen to further our national self-interest, well, you know, that happens sometimes, and that's to be applauded and used, and it makes us look a little better, but that's not the point governing. That's not why we have a government, it's to defend ourselves.
So is the answer yes, or this thing in U.S. law, that is that emphatically, I agree with it?
Well, one thing I hope, if you sit through my sessions this week, I'm doing a whole series of five sessions called Faith and Law. And originally I was going to start with 2 days of theory. One, what is law, and then why do we obey or disobey laws? And then develop some case studies, sanctuary, church infiltration, and the notion of what is a right. Instead, we've reversed things because we're starting the week with a forum and I'm starting with the case studies. But over the course of the week, we're going to be dealing with that question of conflicting laws. Is there such a thing as law? And what are the variety of laws, the various jurisdictions? Does law have anything to do with morals? Or is it simply a question of political force? We're going to be going at that all week. And then what do Christians who are in good conscience trying to, you know, respect order and law and Romans 13 and all that, what do Christians do in that legal order? So we're going to be chewing on that one all week.
Can you make a statement where you're at right now, or
is
it directing the law?
I don't think that the sanctuary movement is, but the Attorney General would certainly disagree with me, and it's a question for the courts to decide. And even if the courts do decide that they're breaking the law, that won't mean I might change my... That doesn't mean I'd change my mind about the validity of sanctuary.
One of the things I find very interesting in this is that as the argument increases that... the Attorney General, the head of the INS, and probably the next Chief Justice of the Supreme Court are all going to be Lutherans. And which makes it a very interesting discussion for Lutheran churches as to what their leaders in government are doing as Christian church men in this case.
I do know that Presiding Bishop David Preuss and Chuck Lutz and Alan Nelson, who's head of the INS, have all sat down. Alan Nelson is his name, and he gave a speech in Vital Speeches of the Day that called on sanctuary, humanitarianism, politics, or pure lawlessness. And he said it's a combination of the three, inclining towards the latter.
Yeah, you know, I find, you know, your comment about the law a rather sophisticated argument, and it still breaks down to, I think, basically for most people, your question, are we breaking the law? And so I encourage people to attend your sessions, because most people haven't done the sophisticated work that you've done. Maybe we will end up breaking the law.
Who knows? To be continued, I guess.
To be continued.
I don't have a profound parting shot here.
Yeah, sleep well.